Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the DanJohnUniversity.com podcast. I'm Dan John, and this is episode 134, which is, we're getting up there. We're sneaking up on 3 years, and I'm happy to be here each and every week. Reminder, I know a lot of you don't watch to the end, but if you have a question, podcast at DanJohnUniversity.com, and I'm always happy to answer each and every question. We have some questions today that I think are pretty good. One of the things is when I read some of the questions, it seems to me a lot of people ask me questions, but they kind of don't know my work. So, you know, I mean, I guess the easiest way would be sign up at danjohnuniversity.com. But I also have books at On Target Publications, otppublications.com. I have two websites, danjohn.net with all that free information, and danjohnuniversity.com, which we do. There is a charge after the free membership, but I think it's worth the time and money. So when I email people, one of the things, I have this little thing at the bottom of after my signature, most questions have been answered here already, and I link to my forums and I link to my sites, but you know, a lot of people don't like to do that. Again, I'm always happy to answer questions on my podcast. I'm always happy. But just remember that there's a lot more information out there and a lot more clarity sometimes when I answer questions in writing versus when I talk, okay? All right, let's begin then. We got a question from Eli. He says this: I was wondering what experience and opinions you had with Every Minute on the Minute style of program. You know, it's funny because now that we have the acronym EMOM, everyone thinks it's something new. There is nothing new about this. We were doing this, we did this when I was in high school. It is how we did circuit training back in the day. In fact, the system of circuit training I do, Gernot's, my good friend from Germany's 30-30 for 30 protocol. And if you type my name in Eli, Dan John, 30/34, F-O-R 30, you'll find that I've written 5 articles at the OTP website on this. In the early 90s, I was told at Olympic Training Center that timed rest periods was actually better for you. And I think for elevated testosterone naturally and growth hormone release, the 1 minute rest was best. So there's nothing new here, but let's go. I've recently started using them a lot for conditioning and technique work. They allow me to use a moderate load and make it feel heavy while not risking technical breakdown. Okay. They also keep my heart rate elevated. I know your transformation program is EMOM-ish with 60-second strict rest periods of sets, but I wondered if you had any other insight in the style of training. Thank you. Yeah, the other thing after this, Eli, my good friend, and I think the man is a genius, Rusty Moore. He's over at Visual Impact, I think, but just type in Rusty Moore, M-O-O-R-E. He has a program called Lightning Rounds, where basically it's very, very easy reps every 30 seconds. It's called Lightning Rounds. I'm a big fan of it. In fact, in the book, one of the chapters is called Dan John Protocols or something like that. We offer one of them. It's kind of funny. He called it in the book the Erica, because one of our training partners, Erica, came up with it. But she does 2 goblet squats and 1 push-up every 30 seconds, 30 times. So in 15 minutes, 60 squats and 30 push-ups, and that's the warm-up. And I'm like, damn, what's going to throw you off, Eli, on this stuff is that it's goblet squat, on the ground, push-up, back up. That's where the heart rate gets shot up. For me, I like this kind of training program. If there's a mix of exercises, I call it level changes. So there's a standing exercise, another level will be on the ground. It can be half kneeling. It can be jumping. It could be walking. But I like to switch things up physically so that you're getting that extra hit of getting up and down off the ground or off the knees or whatever. Yeah, I'm a big fan, especially if you have your... So inside this is my phone. And inside my phone, I have a little timer. And what I like about that is I press, boop, and it goes 10987654321. It goes beep, beep, beep. And every 30 seconds or every minute or whatever, it beeps and it tells me what to do. And then you set that for 15 minutes or 30 minutes. And all you do is focus on the exercises, and it just frees your mind up. So when I hear beep, beep, beep in my gym, even if I'm doing an Olympic lifting workout and I hear beep, 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 it's funny because I'll, for about a second or so, be like, oh, I got to go. Yeah. So I'm a big fan. I like it a lot. The benefits are probably just fine and pretty good, and that's pretty high praise. And the one thing I do like about these things, it seems like you can do these a long time. You can do these kinds of lightning round workouts, circuit training workouts. You can do them for a while. I mean, you can do them easily for 6-8 weeks without making many major changes at all. And that's hard to do. So I hope that helped. We have a question from Marty. I have a training predicament that I'd like you to weigh in on. I'm 31, and for the past 6 years, I've worked on a towboat with a 14 days on, 14 days off schedule. Ooh. Due to being gone so much, I have built all my training around body weight and kettlebells, as space can be limited on the boat. The past 2 years being mostly kettlebells. So, it's kind of cool, really. I started out doing some park bench workouts and have since done your RKC prep and multiple programs from Jeff Newport and Joe Daniels. While this training style is my favorite, I still missed the bar and would like to get back. Do you have any suggestions for programming where I could do Olympic powerlifting when I'm home and continue my kettlebell bodyweight routine while at work? Well, my answer is, Marty, just do it. It's a great idea. Here's the nice thing. For 2 weeks, if you did, you mixed up calisthenics with kettlebells. And to me, I got a workout called the Humane Burpee, the Armor Building Complex. You said you did the RKC prep thing. That's fine. The rite of passage, that'd be great. You know, 3 days a week, 2 days a week mobility. And then when you're not on the boat, it says here Olympic powerlifting. But I mean, if you did the Olympic lifts 3 days a week, and I don't know if you, depending on your time, tossed in, well, if you're doing the clean and press, well, just old school, the pre-1972, you're doing the clean and press, a snatch variation, clean and jerk variation, and front squats. I don't know what else you would need 3 days a week. You might say, well, I need bench press, or fine, bench press, but that's a good program. So for me, I would just, when you're on the boat, you're a kettlebell calisthenic guy. When you're home, you're Olympic lifting, powerlifting, whatever you put together with the barbell. And the nice thing is 2 weeks is right on that brink of being like, for most people, it's time to change things. Well, for you, it's built in. You hit that 2 weeks of Olympic lifting, you're on the boat, and things are, I think, for the space between your ears, you're going to find this to be a very good program. Good question, Marty. Thank you. We have a question from Dan. Dan says, I've heard you talk about methods of training athletes, throwers, for example, that lead to a shift in being a thrower who lifts versus a lifter who throws. What is the tipping point in this occurring? Well, actually, it's bigger than you think. The times, J.K. Doherty, in his wonderful second edition of the Track and Field Omni book, talked about an era where 90% of what shot putters did was just throwing, and the other 10% was going for walks, pull-ups, and sprinting. And really, that was it. And then when weightlifting came around, and Perry O'Brien and some of those early pioneers that were doing the weight room, they became a little bit more what we would call balanced. Now, I mean, there was, I mean, I don't know, some percent of the training was, a higher percent was lifting, let's say 50-50, which is a lot. But then some shot putters realized that with certain magical performance aids that are banned and immoral and illegal where I live, they could lift weights 90% of the time and spend 10% of the time just doing the shot put. And it's interesting because they really threw far. And I remember one guy telling me the only time he ever trained the shot put was at track meets, and he tried to compete every Saturday, either at an all-comer meet or a small meet or a college meet or an invitational. And I remember thinking, holy cow, but that was making, you know, he had a very simple technique, and he was getting as strong as he could. What's interesting was the change when Al Feuerbach, the shot putter, came along, and Feuerbach basically said that 60% of his training was throwing the shot put, and 40% was being an Olympic lifter with some additional pressing movements. And Doherty praised that. And so by this little history lesson, I just want you to realize that most people go through the same history lesson. Usually young athletes just want to play the sport, and then they start lifting weights and they just fall in love with lifting weights. So first it's just the sport, and then it's the sport with lifting weights. And then one day, ideally, you know, a good coach will say, let's balance this up. Coach Mon at Utah State, my coach, famously told me, I asked him, what's the secret to being a great thrower? And he said, lift weights 3 days a week, throw 4 days a week for the next 8 years. And of course, the joke is it's the 8 years that most people don't hear. So that's probably about the ballpark that you'd want to do things. 3 days a week, lift, 4 days a week, your sport, unless you have more time. And if you have more time and you're a professional athlete and you go to, you know, films and chalk talks and board stuff and walkthroughs, obviously that's going to be a daily thing but the rules are different. But for most people, there is that it tends to take a bit of an intervention by somebody else's eyes or vision to convince you that the weight room wasn't, you know, what you weren't interested in the weight room, and then the weight room becomes the answer. And then, of course, after that, you slide back to a more balanced approach. I don't have any numbers to tell you about. I don't have any. Let's just do this. Let's give you Tom Fahey's discus numbers. Tom told me that as a male discus thrower, if I bench 400 pounds, snatch 250, clean 300, back squat 450, which are all extremely light lifts, I mean, to be honest with you, you're strong enough to be an international level thrower, and you have to quit blaming the weight room for your lack of improvement. And that's when you have to go back into the field and say, I can't just throw. I need to think things through. So that's when instead of having the sector this wide, you make a little narrow band of a sector. You know, you try to throw things in the garbage cans. You practice just, you know, like one throw every 10 minutes, because that's what happens in meet sometimes. My thrower this last weekend had about a 3 or 4 hour pause between her first three throws and her last three throws. How do you train that? Because you have to train it, just like I just said. Three throws, long pause, three throws. That's a hard thing to train for. I don't know where the line in the sand is with every single athlete, but if you have any kind of break after a season and you take out, you take out a piece of paper and a pen and you start writing things down, very often the clarity will come out either in your journal or diary or with the help of another coach. That's what I found almost universally. It takes an intervention by either a coach, a trusted friend, teammate, or your review of things to pick up when that happens. Thank you. That was a very good question. An interesting question now from Tyler, and it's a bit personal, but with the tragic news of Bud Jeffrey's passing, I have been reading his books again, and I noticed both that he mentions your work easy strength quite a bit and that your philosophies have a lot in common. With that, I was wondering if you two knew each other, if you guys have talked training, and if you'd say there's anything you'd learn from Bud. Yeah, I like Bud a lot. I like Bud a lot. One of my favorite nights was him. I know Dave Whitley was there. I want to say Brett Jones was at the table with us too. And we just started talking, and it was just, then I looked around and I noticed that there was all these heads in between each one of us, because all these young coaches and lifters and stuff were just listening in. Bud, you know, when Bud did his big weight loss, that was really kind of interesting to watch because his approach, his strongman insights were very good. What was weird about Bud is not, I mean, he looked really strong, right? And so when you saw his big engine, you'd be like, and you saw him do something like, pick up a rock or an anvil, be like, nah, okay, of course, you know, his big engine, you know? But then you'd see him do flexibility and mobility work and be like, maybe I should shut up and, you know, do more flexibility. Cause he almost looked like, it was weird watching him do some of his stretches cause he was so freakishly flexible and it just kind of looked wrong, you know? He'll be missed. Of course, you know, his last years had, you know, tragedy, lost his son. And, you know, I don't know of a person that wasn't touched by that event at so many different levels. And then not long after, of course, you know, Bud died training, you know, which is, it's terrible, but there's some of us that would rather die, you know, snatching and clean and jerking than a lot of other ways, you know? So, yeah, I like Bud. I liked his work a lot. I learned a lot from him. He fit well in that, you know, little and often over the long haul approach to getting strong or whatever your goal is. So, yeah, another loss. And it's a rare week, it seems, that I haven't lost someone lately. So, yeah, I appreciate your question. And thank you for letting me share a few thoughts, okay? I appreciate it. Okay, we have a question from Eric, and Eric says, over a year ago, this is a rather long one, but I think it's good. I emailed to ask about the Humane Burpee and Dan Martin Program Minimum, the DMPM. Now, 1 year, I wanted to give some feedback. Over the last year, I've trained 5 days a week on average, which is great, except when life gets in the way. I've been using a 24 kilo primarily, and he tosses in the 32 intermittently. My volume on swings has ranged from 50 a workout, good, if I'm using the 32 and focusing on the snap, up to 200, which is that's a solid number of swings in a workout. My goblet squats range from 15 to 50, and push-ups from 30 to 150. This is an interesting insights here. During that time, I've noticed that I got respectable workouts done in about 10 to 15 minutes, right? And that I could leave feeling good enough to keep going if I needed to. I learned to appreciate stretching, especially my pecs and hamstrings. Boy, that's so true. And I definitely learned how much volume can impact putting on muscle mass. After this past year, I learned that a lot of conventional wisdom about training might have hampered my development athletically, and that consistency definitely trumps everything else. Agreed. I've largely gone back to doing calisthenics at this time, wanting to see how far I can get with volume and consistency. But I think that the lessons that can be learned from taking the Dan Martin Program Minimum seriously have been absolutely invaluable. For more information on that workout, go to the DaveDraper.com forum, go to my Q&A, the Dan John Q&A, and then you'll just see it's in the sticky at the top, what Dan does. And you could also just search the forum and you'll get a lot of posts about it. But basically, Dan Martin did something that very few people will do. He took his ego and put it aside. I'm done. No. And he decided after working with me in the beginning, he said, you know, I'm just going to do things and I'm going to turn things around. He had some issues and he decided that he would do goblet squats every day, parts of the Turkish get up every day, walk every day, one or two loaded carries, and just gently, methodically bring himself back. And it has been an eye-opening experiment for the rest of us watching him, because it is working well. So remember that sometimes that just doing the basics, whatever 5 times 52 is, you know, 52 weeks of the year, 5 days a week. I'm sure I could figure it out if I took a second. Is just as good as a lot of the nonsense you see us do. Okay. Well, thank you. That was a good review, Eric, and I really appreciate it. Well, Neil asks us, What do you think of the old Pelawan style of high rep calisthenics for building muscle and explosiveness? I'm referring to workouts such as Green Ganma, Ric Flair, Ken Shamrock. You'd also add in the running back from Georgia, Herschel Walker, allegedly performing 500 repetitions of Hindu squats every day. Are there any benefits to this style of training, or is it outdated by today's standards? Yeah, I will say this. I think it's outdated by today's standards. Having said that, I also think there is a value. There is no great reason to do 500 bodyweight squats a day. There's no real great reason. But if you said, you know, Dan, my goal for this year is to do that, you know, I want to do 500 squats, you know, 20 days in a month. So the 10,000 bodyweight squats challenge. There you go. I think there's great value in the challenge of it. The same way there's great value in the challenge of the 10,000 kettlebell swing challenge. In the same way, there's a value in finishing a triathlon, as I've finished several, or running a marathon under, you know, in a reason, you know, basically don't walk it. Well, walk fast anyway, or whatever. I am a big believer that challenges have a value, but for training, I think there's much better ways to do this. Oh, and he actually says this. 500 reps of Hindu squats performed daily for 20 days sounds awfully similar to a kettlebell swing challenge. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Again, the challenge has benefits. And then from there, you take the benefits of what did you learn from that challenge and apply it to the rest of your normal training. I get very few benefits out of the 10,000 kettlebell swing challenge. Now, it could be because I hate it and I don't do my swings optimally because I hate it. Because I've done it so many times. But after I do it, I go to a weightlifting meet and I notice that certain things have improved. So even as much as I hate that 20 days a year, I have 345 after that, 346 on leap years, to do what I think I like to do. And that's the value of a challenge. Thank you, Neil. That's a good question. We have a question from Kasperi, and I know you hate double kettlebell snatches. I hate them because I think they're dangerous. But what are your thoughts on double kettlebell swings? Oh, they're fine. They're fine, yeah. In fact, double kettlebell swings was the roots of one of my best training programs, the one I called Left of Passage, that I did in a very, very busy time of my life. And then I started mixing double kettlebell, so a kettlebell in each hand, double kettlebell, you know, swings with farmer walks, swings with rack walks, swings with seesaw press. Those were tough, man. Many double kettlebell programs have them, and I was wondering if I should be doing them or just stick to swings with a single kettlebell. Using two kettlebells obviously makes you use a bigger load. If double kettlebell swings are worth doing, should I swing them between the legs or outside the legs? Or just mix them up? Kasperi, I've never been a fan of that outside one. I understand why it came along was because we had some very, very large power lifters need to do it. This is just my weightlifting background. You know, it's funny, when I do them, the outside the knees one, I can see why people like it. It does cut down the training. And I don't know why I don't like them. I hate to sound like I'm a purist, okay? but I think you'll find either one, if you like them, to both be valuable. Thank you. We got a question from Enrique. I think Enrique asks a question every week. He says, rewatching the Beowulf workshop. It's a workshop I did on YouTube about the book, the poem Beowulf. I noticed once again the part about the quiet professional and orphans in Western literature and culture. Could you expand on why it is important or valuable to be the quiet professional? Well, you know, it's only in one area. Well, it could also be, and it's only area of especially special forces, and anybody who would be a military or our police special forces person, when you write a book, when you give interviews, especially on current situations, you literally are giving the enemy information. I'm not going to mention any authors specifically because that's not my job, but I remember being with a couple of people, and two of them are no longer alive. They were killed in action. And we were discussing a famous book, and the person who was killed in action, I remember leaning across the dining table and kind of doing the whole point at your chest. This book has the way we do our operations. It includes the number of people who do this. It includes it includes information that will be helpful to the enemy. And I don't want to get any more specific than that, but when I was driving with a former member of one of probably the most elite fighting force Americans have, this came up, and it was interesting because the term is, and I think it's okay for me to share it, is PNG, persona non grata, gratis. If you write a book, you're not welcome anymore. It's okay to write a book. If it's approved, you got to send it to people to say, okay, this is fine. You know, there's nothing here that's going to help the enemy. And of course, if you wrote a book from, you know, about, I don't know, your experiences somewhere in 1962, I'm sure that's fine-ish. But there's you still have to be careful about giving away information. Also, if you let everybody in the planet know you're a member of this or that, you also endanger the family members of your team. And that's something that I take very close to the heart. So Enrique, that's a basic, but I mean, it's a very, very small percent of the people I work with, you know, so, but it's still something I hold close to my heart. Okay. Thank you. Niall asks a question. Well, I've just reread Never Let Go as I turn 30. And that combination has reminded me of all the things that younger me wanted to learn and do, but never quite managed in the last decade. I'm currently doing the program from Fat Loss Happens on Monday. It's like easy strength with fewer days. So great for busy periods at work. Good. And the workouts are pretty simple. There's a couple that are pretty fast. Yeah. But how is this sensible path over the next couple of years, interspersed with easy strength and periodic body weight work? Sort out body composition with my current program. I'm 6 foot, 87 kilos in not bad, but fatter than I like shape. I like that. So for my American audience, he weighs about 190 at 6 foot. And that's funny because that's an unusual nowadays. And that's pretty lean for nowadays. He's closing in on his half body weight kettlebell press. Currently stuck at 36, which is fine. 1.5 bench body weight bench press, good. And double body weight deadlift, about 10K out of each. And the 5-minute snatch test, and he says it's harder. Those are all, that's a good set of goals. I like that. The half body weight single arm kettlebell press, the big bench, the big deadlift, and the 5-minute snatch test, that's great. He wants to learn the basics of Olympic lifting, actually compete in a powerlifting meet, experiment with strongman and Highland Games. I'd appreciate any wisdom on mapping out this path. Well, yeah, you're 30. I don't know if you'd want to do an order here, but I would recommend if you learn the Olympic lifts, keep training the way you're training, because I like that. But learn the Olympic lifts as soon as you can, because that will be a nice base for all three of the other things. Powerlifting, you know, I never trained the deadlift, but I had the biggest deadlift at that powerlifting meet. And if I'd have known about straps and depth, check that. If I'd have known about depth, I think I would have had the biggest squat at the meet. What I thought a squat was and what the powerlifters thought a squat was not the same at the time, but it's their sport and I appreciate it. And then once you Olympic lift, when you slide over to things like the strongman and the Highland Games, you'll have a good base to be a thrower. I like what you're doing here. You could even say something like you would do in the fall is your Olympic lifting time of year, winter is powerlifting, and then Highland Games in the spring and summer if you work it out. That's pretty fun. That's kind of what I kind of sort of what I used to do. And I really enjoyed it. So, hey, I love what you're doing. Love it, Niall. So the thing is, you got to go buy yourself a kilt. You got to buy yourself some kind of shoe for Highland Games, weightlifting boots, a belt, a singlet. And you can those will be able to wear into a powerlifting meet. And you're going to have to join a bunch of federations, but you're on the right track. Okay, thanks. We got a question from David. Ooh, and this one's an interesting one. This is a tough one. David says, I'm trying to teach my fiance how to do the getup. She most assuredly has gluteal amnesia, as it's called. Wow, that's, there's probably a better toolkit than the getup. But she does fairly well throughout the movement, but just cannot seem to get from that half kneeling to standing. She is strong-willed, to say the least, and shuts down if I push her in some things. So I'm trying to find a way to help her strengthen her glutes so that she can make the last transition. Okay, that might be true, but there's something even bigger. Yeah, this is a patterning question, I think. If you got kettlebells, goblet squats, swings, and then doing the hip thrust on the ground, that's your money for the glutes. Hip thrust, swings, man, those are great. And the glute right after, that's good. But there's a thing I want to talk about in just a second. Okay, she refuses to squat, okay, except the goblet squat. But even in that, she can't break parallel with her thighs. If this was your paying client, how would you as a strength coach get her where she needs to be? So, I mean, she's goblet squatting, Bulgarian goat bag swings. If you don't know it, look it up. Oh, just YouTube it. I've got a ton of things on it. But there is, okay, I think you have a patterning issue. So what I would do, there'd be two things I'd want to do. Now, I'm not a huge fan of lunges, but what I would recommend first is, so start in the waiter walk position, okay? And have her like step over something, you know, so I'm looking around for a height. But maybe a short, we'll start with a, yeah, just on the step over, start with a short box or something, anything, a gym bag. So have her stand, step back over it, bring the leg back, step back over it, bring the leg back, step back over it, bring the leg back. Then put in a higher bag or a higher bench and start in that start with her, So her front foot is here, her back foot is here, and in the middle is the bench. And just have her practice bringing that, so if it's in my right hand, it'd be my left knee. Just do a little touch and go, touch and go, touch and go lunge. Then go to a lower, however you do this, I don't know, just think it through. A lower box, touch and go, touch and go, touch and go. That might be enough for one day. Come back the next day and go down, go down, and go down. Because some people need a target when they do lunges. And I know sometimes we just throw a whole bunch of lunges and burpees and all that crap at people without doing any actual thinking. But if someone is struggling in a position, it does help to bring them gradually down. Because sometimes I'll see people do, it's not a Turkish get-up lunge, but a normal lunge. And you'll see them do all this extra stuff because they've never been taught on a lunge that a lunge is when your knee comes down to the ground, not when you throw your whole body in these different directions and your knee accidentally hits the ground for some weird reason. So you got to teach yourself to be in a good position and bring your knee to the ground versus just, doing the crap you see everybody do. The fact that you're teaching your fiance and all, it should be, you're going to learn a lot about what's coming up for you. Okay. Listen, that's it. That was an easy episode. The questions were good. They were to the point. I am happy to have answered them. As always, if you have a question, podcast@danjohnuniversity.com. I'll do my best to answer each and every one. Keep them coming in. A lot of people have told me that they are now on the forum and they find it's pretty good to ask the question on the forum. I'll answer it as best as I can, but you also get other people who might have the same challenge as you, and that kind of helps. So, forum, the forum at Dan John University, or the forum at Dave Draper in the Dan John Q&A. I'm always happy to answer questions any way I can, okay? Well, thank you. And until next week, let's all keep on lifting and learning, okay?